chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, I say now Chapelboro rather than our Chapel Hill or Carrboro neighbor. Sherry Castle is a popular food writer. She's well known around this region as a teacher about cooking. And in all of that, and as a freelance writer for many publications, she's known as somebody who celebrates the pleasures of fresh and local and seasonal food and the results that you can get from them in the kitchen with the kinds of home-cooked meals that we like to remember and dream about. And she's packaged all of that enthusiasm in a new book, which is called The New Southern Garden Cookbook, Enjoying the Best from Homegrown Gardens, Farmers Markets, Roadside Stands, and CSA Farm Boxes. Welcome, Sherry
Happy
Castle.
Happy to be here.
We were talking before we got started. I said that I had to look up CSA and some people and said that might be Confederate States of America. You said, well, that's okay. It's Southern cooking. But that's not. I was on the wrong track, wasn't I?
A little bit on the wrong track, and I'm surprised no one else has thought that's what that stood for. That amused me greatly.
I was born back in those times. So.
Exactly. No, a CSA Farm Box. CSA is an acronym for Community Supported Agriculture, but a lot of people call it Farm Box out of affection and because that's descriptive. It's basically a subscription service to a local farm or perhaps a cooperative of local growers where a family or a person says, I'm going to subscribe to so many weeks of a farm box. It's like subscribing to a magazine. And in exchange, they get regular deliveries of fresh local food from that farm or group of farmers. And for the farmer, the advantage is they have a built-in audience. They know how many people are going to be purchasing their things, in what intervals, what their output needs to be, and they can focus on growing good food instead of figuring out how to sell that food. The advantage of the subscriber is they get regular deliveries of the best local freshest food around. So it's a good thing for both parties.
Yeah, my children are into this and they have enjoyed, and they can even buy half a box. Mm-hmm. You know, you split it up and they make friends and neighbors with the other subscribers. And it solves a problem for me that, that your new book also begins to help solve is that I don't really know what is fresh. You know, some people would say, just bring me what is the right off the vine or right out of the ground. I'd like to get the freshest stuff. Well, in this, you automatically get it because it's just what the farmers pulled up that day.
Exactly. And, you know, when you shop in grocery stores, and of course there's good things in grocery stores too, but, you know, there's all things all the time. Maybe not in the best form, but you get the impression that there's no season for anything. It's all kind of shiny and polished up and under, you know, the lights and so forth. And you lose that sense of when things are in their best condition. You know, we can eat asparagus for Christmas, but it's really a spring thing. And we all know that, you know, tomatoes in January are a sad and sorry thing usually. But if we wait till they're, you know, in the summer when they're fresh and local, who can resist the temptation of what I like to call a lean over tomato? One of those you got to lean way over because it's going to drip off your elbows.
No, that's right. Well, just recently we had the strawberry season and you could go out and pick. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing that you celebrate in your book that you have the social occasion and then you go get it and you know that it's fresh because you picked it. Or you go out and get it right off the stand and you're pretty close to being sure. But I had you're talking about the grocery store. I love my grocery stores, but don't get me wrong. But I did strawberries were on special because I guess they were competing with the fresh stuff. And so I'd gotten some fresh berries from maybe 2,000 or 3,000 miles away, mm-hmm. supposedly. And then my children brought me fresh berries that they just picked, and I had them up against each other. And there's this hard, you know, kind of mm-hmm. rough. I mean, it's good. And then you put one of these melt in your mouth, fresh off, freshly picked strawberries, and it makes a difference.
It makes a difference. And, you know, it's a very simple thing that the longer a strawberry can stay on the vine in the sunshine, turning fully red and ripe and getting its own natural sweetness, it's going to be different from a berry that was picked for shipability, where it was picked when it was hard as a rock, green as a gourd, as my granddaddy would say, and, you know, basically impervious to anything, as it could be shipped across many time zones and so forth. The one that was ripened naturally is going to be sweet. The one that's ripened artificially, not so much.
Yeah, not quite as good. My buddies down in the Sandhills grow peaches, mm-hmm. and so they have to pack them both for the market and pack them for the people who stop by their shed. And so the if you're packing it to go somewhere, even if it's just for a day or two, but it's going to be, it's got to be picked just a little bit early, and it's just not, it will ripen, but it won't ripen the same way as one that's just off the tree.
Exactly. I think that's one of the reasons people say things don't taste as good as they used to. Well, they're not what they used to. You know, it really, it's, you know, when we used to all have gardens or access to one, even people that lived in town, you had immediacy by default, and now we realize what a privilege it is to have that.
Well, let's talk about your book just a little bit. And since we've been talking about strawberries, you've done on your, you've organized your book just a little bit differently from what I might have expected. What I might have thought when you're celebrating the seasonal aspects of good, that you might have organized it by season, but you've organized it by ingredients. And so we'll talk some about that. But since we're talking about strawberries, talk about some of the things that you do in your book with strawberries.
And well, I obviously have some desserts. That's you know, yeah. an easy thing
There's
to
a
do.
Chapter on strawberries.
There's a chapter on strawberries. There's a chapter on about 40 different fruits and vegetables. And my organization is by that fruit or vegetable as the starting point. So it's apples through zucchini in alphabetical order. And that's the first decision I made about the book. Before I even knew which categories there would be, and certainly which recipes would fall under those categories, I knew this is the way I wanted to do it. And I had a couple of reasons. One is that is how fresh food tends to come in our life. We go to the market or to the pick your own or get our CSA box or even go to, you know, a local market and we see, wow, look at those apples or look at those green beans. This is what's in profusion and in its best form right now. And if you get the good stuff, it's easy for the cooking to follow.
So you said this is a new approach. I think you converted me that if you're cooking and instead of saying, I'm going to the market to get the ingredients for a dish that I've already picked out, maybe I go to the market and I see what's there and what's available, what's best. Then I come home and I look for a way to cook it, mm-hmm. and you got it all organized. Mm-hmm. Whether it's different kinds of squash or whether it's strawberries or apples or whatever, or asparagus, these other great fresh foods. We find it at the market, and then we come home and get Sherry's cookbook out, and she tells us how to, some various ways we can use
exactly.
that particular.
And, you know, clearly things have a season, as we've been talking, but within the South, even within the state of North Carolina, much less the country, those seasons aren't the same for everyone. I'm from the mountains of North Carolina. My dad is still getting frost at night, or at least has the threat of it. If you go down east, we're starting to get almost some things you could consider a summer item. So we'll all get these things in due time, but not at the same time, which is the reason that I didn't go by season per se, although that's certainly implied. And, you know, I do organize the book by the predominant fruit or vegetable as the ingredient, but this isn't a side dish book. It isn't, you know, necessarily vegetarian. It's just a way of showing that we have good options for incorporating fresh products within our meals through the year.
Yeah, it's a big book and it's beautiful. Still might be something that would be fun to take to the farmer's market with you and you could run across strawberries or blackberries or, you know, whatever the berry, the squash,
right.
the asparagus might be in that season. And you could say, hey, oh, it's fresh. And here's the recipe I'd like to.
Exactly. And, you know, you can use the book that way, too. If you want a good dessert or a soup or something, all those traditional categories that we see in cookbooks are in the index. It's just not the way it's organized. It's just a different way of presenting the same sorts of information.
All right. Well, I can't get strawberries off my mind. What are you going to do to make me hungry by telling me about the strawberry dishes?
Oh, there is one of my favorite desserts is a strawberry tiramisu. And I find a lot of Mediterranean influence in traditional Southern cooking, or maybe the other way around, but I see great similarity. So I am making, instead of a tiramisu, which is a fairly popular dessert that has coffee and espresso and things in it, I make it with fresh strawberries, little crisp cookies, mascarpone, and whipped cream, and layer them up as a parfait. So it's something very traditional, a trifle or parfait, but with a little bit of a modern twist, and that, I think, is a real indicator of how I cook. It's not anything that's going to be too far out there, but it may be an updated or slightly more creative version than we've seen before.
We're visiting with Sherry Castle about her brand new book. It's called The New Southern Garden Cookbook, Enjoying the Best from Homegrown Gardens, Farmers Markets, Roadside Stands, and CSA Farm Boxes. She and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Sherry Castle, who's well-known local Chapel Carver, or maybe we should say Chapelboro personality, who's well-known as a teacher of cooking, a writer about, a freelance writer about cooking, and some other things we're going to talk about later. Okay. As we talked about strawberries and what you can do with strawberries, you mentioned something that really interested me that you talked about a little bit in your book, and that is you said, I'm working with strawberries and I'm working with the traditional American dishes, but it's got kind of like European, Italian flavor to it. And in your book, you said, you know, I learned more about American, about Southern cooking in Italy almost than I did growing up. But I just thought, I want her to explain that. How can you learn about Southern cooking, your own home cooking, by learning about Italian cooking?
Well, sometimes maybe you can't see the forest for the trees. I had obviously grown up, you know, with traditional Southern food and so forth, but I aspired to be a cook of international food, particularly Mediterranean food. I have a deep affinity for Italy and Spain, and it was one of my very first trips to Italy. I was in the middle of the country in their hill country, and I was having a meal, and it was magnificent, and I was excited because it was, you know, foreign food, Italian food, trying to get the sense of place and cultural import and, you know, history and so forth. And I looked down and I thought, this is what I grew up with. This is the same food, the ingredients, the point of view, the preparation methods, the way people described it. And it was an epiphany. That's the only word I can use.
Well, can you be specific about it? What kind of dish was it?
It was a meal. I was in a farmhouse and it was in the rolling blue hills. It looked a dead ringer for the Yadkin Valley. I mean, if you had blindfolded me and revealed before me and said, where are you on the planet? I'd have said, I'm coming down off the mountain, out of the hills, and heading into the Yadkin Valley, because that's what the farmland looked like. It's what the air smelled like. It's what the communities looked like. And I was having this supper in Italy that this...
What was it? Can you remember what it was?
I will never forget what it was. We had some homemade fresh pork sausage that had been made that day. We had what I would call a pot of soup beans, but fresh shell beans cooked in a soupy liquid, you know, with a tiny bit of pork seasoning in it. We had stewed apples. We had roasted pumpkin. We had greens. We had a big pot of greens.
Oh, come on.
Over the
now, that could have been, you could have been at home in the
exactly.
mountains.
Exactly. And we had a big cake of bread that we baked in the hearth that looked like an overgrown biscuit, what we'd have called all-together bread, where you just break off a hunk to use for sopping. I don't know the Italian word for sopping, but I'm convinced they do it. And I realized this is the food I grew up with. And if this food has cultural relevance, importance, and is worth of deep respect and introspection in Italy, it's just as valid back home. And it changed my point of view on everything. I realized that the food I grew up with, our Southern traditions or our new Southern traditions, are a measure of our own culture, a reflection of who we are, a reflection of what we value. If you want to know what people think, look at what they eat and where they shop. And I had to go all the way to Italy to turn around and appreciate my own backyard.
Well, that's a great story. That's a great story. Well, I want you to take it. You didn't talk about this in your book, and so you can just say, DG, I don't want to. You're taking me someplace I can't go. But when you came back and you looked for the equivalent, the parallel, the kind of a meal that would enable you to say, okay, my region's cooking is not only does the Italian hill country farmer's meal remind me of my growing up, but what I can get where I came from reminds me of Italy. Is there something equivalent? If you were telling somebody from Italy, come over here and I'll give you I'll take you someplace where you can get a meal much like much like that. We'll put them up against each other.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, they would realize or certainly comprehend, as we do on some level, that pride of place. You know, communities, although it's a little harder to find, there are still communities that have their dishes. It's like, this is who we are. This is what we make. This is our Brunswick
stew. Take us back to your grandmama's kitchen and maybe something.
Oh, my gosh. There would have been, you know, we ate out of the garden all summer long, as much as we could hold fresh. And then she put up the rest to eat through the winter. You know, she canned and pickled.
I'm just trying to get you to describe what might be on the table.
Okay, through the week, we ate from the garden, and if there was any meat at all, it might have been a piece of fried bologna with an X cut in the middle so it wouldn't curl up. And, you know, just a lot of out of the garden. There would be lots of pickles and preserves and vinegars. It was an array of flavors. I like to say that Southerners can mix and match a palate on their plate to have endless combinations of flavors, a little sweet, a little salty, a little hot. You know, that we mix and match with all of the things. And then it would build up to Sunday dinner. You know, those mythical.
All right, put yourself back there in your grandmama's table and remember some of those great things that she put there in front of you.
Oh, gosh. There would be lots and lots of beans in any form. Big bowls in the summer of half-runner green beans that we'd set on the porch and pulled the strings off and snapped and talked and worked up those beans. There would be platters of sliced tomatoes and, you know, good salt to go with it. She didn't know of basil. Basil was later. She was a mountain woman. They didn't have basil. But there would be corn, either pickled or creamed corn or maybe corn on the cob. We would have new potatoes. We'd have potatoes in some form far more often than rice. Mountain people are tater people, not rice people necessarily. There would be hot bread of at least one kind, maybe two or three. There would be, you know, hot water cornbread wafers out of a skillet, a big cake of cornbread, maybe biscuits if there was time. Through the week, if there was any dessert, it would be because it was somebody's birthday. But there would be a little something sweet, a bottle of sorghum or some jars of jam. One of my favorite food memories as a child was my granddaddy at the end of the meal, at the end of supper, which was what we called our evening meal. If there was no other sweet or dessert, he would take a clean dinner plate and a gob of butter and put sorghum molasses, and he would stir that butter and molasses with a fork into this smooth paste. And whatever our bread of the day was, cornbread, biscuit, whatever it was, he would swarp us
nothing
off
better,
some of that
nothing better,
and pass it around. And the little ones got theirs first, and he would pass around off of that one dinner plate for everybody, and that was our dessert. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so simple, so inexpensive, so seemingly, you know, you wouldn't brag about that, but I would. I'm old enough where I can brag about.
Well, yeah, I think it's worth bragging about. Yeah. I mean, think about that. They raised the food. It was what our people ate. It's what our stories were about. And, you know, to me, my favorite thing about food, no matter where I go, whether it's the South or Italy or wherever I am, is if you want to get a story going from somebody, use food. It's the most evocative experience that we have. Ask somebody about something that was good that they ate when they were growing up, or something that a loved one made for them, or that they made because they love somebody. There is no more evocative trigger to talk to anyone.
Well, I want to turn that on you and ask you because I love this discussion of your growing up in the mountains, in the mountain, the North Carolina mountain food that you had. So. Out of all of those experiences, some of them made their way into your book. And so give us an example or two of the kinds of food that your grandmother put in front of you or that you got at home and how they made it into the book and whether you had to adjust them a little bit or whether they went in just like you had them when she fixed them.
There were a lot of them that were just like that she fixed. I know one of the very first recipes in the book is skillet apples, where you take, you know, good, sweet, tart.
Tell us that recipe. I love the story of this recipe.
Exactly. Well, you're
starting with bacon.
And often it was bacon because, you know, people sometimes stereotype bacon, but let's face it, it was the fat of the land. There is no cooking culture on the planet that does not have a requirement for fat for cooking. And for traditional Southerners, by default and by choice, it was pork fat because pigs were easy to raise. They produce lots of delicious fat. I mean, it is delicious. People may or may not choose to eat it, but it's, you know, still the most famous cured meats on the planet are usually pork-based. But it gave a little flavor and a little fat to a fairly meager diet. So there's a lot of things that have, you know, a little bacon grease in the bottom of the pan. So these apples, it could be done with bacon grease, or if they'd fried up a little sausage for breakfast or maybe some pork chops, if they'd fried fish, less often with fish, but even a little butter, a little dab of something, whatever's left, a tiny bit just to make the bottom of your skillet a little shiny. You put in wedges of apples.
Oh, to talk about the apples that you get. But be careful if you go to the grocery store, right?
Yeah, you want something that won't fall apart and go mushy. This is a texture thing. And, you know, apples, there used to be over 1,700 kinds of apples in North Carolina alone, and they were task specific. We had apples that got soft. We had apples that made good vinegar. We had apples that were good keepers over the winter. We had some that were only fit for feeding our animals, but food was task specific and had a purpose. So in some ways you can still find an apple like you might use in a pie that's going to keep a little bit of its shape.
Can you give me a name of one or two? Granny Smith, is that a...
It will be, but you know, grannies have unfortunately kind of suffered from their success. Uh-huh. They've sort of declined into vague uniformity in the grocery store.
Well, can you go to the grocery store? You got to go to the market to get this.
No, you could go to the grocery store and maybe a Pink Lady would work. That's a new variety, but still has a little character to it. It's got some sweetness. It won't go mushy. Arkansas Black might do that. A Limber Twig. But when you do go to the market, if you go to a local market, ask the person that grew it. There's no better source of information to know how something's going to be than ask the person that grew it. Say, I want a firm apple. But even if you wind up with a soft apple, it'll still work. Yeah, exactly. But you have just a tiny bit of the fat. A little bacon grease is delicious. Or the butter. And you arrange slices of apples cut into thin wedges. And you cook them slowly until they become tender.
What do you mean cook them? Now, you got that fat in there.
You've got that warmed up.
And then you take these sliced apples. And you just toss them in there.
Toss them in there. And you want them in a fairly shallow layer. So there's a lot of good exposure of the sides of those slices of apples.
Is it a real hot pan?
Bottom. No, you want it pretty slow because you don't want them to scorch.
Do you cover it?
You can cover it a little bit or partially cover it. You know, it depends on how full your skillet is, but holding in a little bit of steam would be a good idea. A little bit of sugar, depending on your personal sweet tooth.
You put regular sugar or brown sugar?
I put regular sugar, but brown sugar would certainly work.
You can let me go anywhere I want to.
Exactly, because this is very flexible cooking because people did it, you know, with what they had. And believe it or not, a tiny pinch of salt, because salt actually accentuates sweetness in food. It makes things taste more like itself.
Little touch.
Just a little bit.
Not to get off track too much, but you're very hard on salt in the box. You say I got to get some kind of special salt.
It's not special anymore. If we were having this conversation certainly 8 years ago, it would seem special. But I see at country stores out in little crossroads across the South, people can get kosher or sea salt
anymore. Yeah, but what's wrong with just regular salt?
Well, to my place, it's only a percentage of salt. There's a lot of additives and fillers.
Really?
There are.
Why do they put anything?
Because it was a marketing thing that people didn't want their salt to cake up, and we became
so
to expect
to keep it from
that
being
salt.
Placed.
Yeah, we came to expect salt to look identical, whether it was in one of those little packets from the drive-thru or whatever. When actually, you know, salt is its own good thing. And if you buy either kosher salt or sea salt or one of those, which are inexpensive, you can get them anywhere now.
All right. Now I did get you off track. Mm-hmm. You persuaded me, but back to the pan. They're in there.
Yes.
It's hot. And when do I take them out?
When you can poke them with a fork. I mean, when they're fully tender all the way through, but not breaking down into applesauce. Tiny bit of sugar, a little bit of salt. Some people, including my grandmother's sister, put a little tiny pinch of red pepper in there to get that little hint of pepper, you know, in addition to the sweet. And they should be tender through and have almost a slight sticky glaze on the outside where the natural apple juice, that little bit of bacon grease or butter, and that sugar, not like a taffy apple, but just a little bit of something. And you can eat them as a side dish with your breakfast. You can put them on biscuits. You can put them with a piece of pound cake. I like mine warm. My husband's family's tradition is to eat them cold the next day.
Oh, wow.
Put them off
just put them in the refrigerator.
He likes his cold. But, you know, they're just a traditional Southerner would call a fried apple.
This would be something if you've got guests and you know, you're really not into cooking, but you wanted to do a little something special for them. Mm-hmm. This would work. I mean, you almost, if you follow your simple instructions and it's right at the beginning of the book, Hard to mess up.
Hard to mess up. And, you know, it's apples. It's not going to be bad no matter what you do, even if they're a little more crumbly than you expect or whatever. And it leads me to two things. One is, even as a professional food writer, I say don't promise too much up front. Don't over-describe. Don't over anything, so that however it turns out is what you meant all along. The other thing I wanted to say is we would call that, most Southerners would, a fried apple. And I think one of the reasons that people who are maybe not fully familiar with our food ways think that we fry everything is, it's a vernacular. People used to say anything made in a skillet, whether it was a speck of fat or a lot, was fried. So there's a lot of things we say are fried that really aren't truly
fried. What's the appropriate way to describe the apples that you and I just cooked?
I would call them fried apples or even stewed apples, mm-hmm. but I just call them skillet apples. Skillet apples.
Yeah.
And I can skillet anything. I have a whole array of skilleted things. And because it's simple, quick, straightforward cooking. It's cooking. You start with one simple thing, do a simple technique, and in about 10 minutes, you have a fine, fine thing
to
eat.
So you're not afraid of a cast iron skillet?
Oh, my gosh. I collect cast iron. I've got cast iron that was like my great-grandmother's, a woman who, passed away decades before I was born. And that's my treasured heirloom. I've written fiction about cast iron skillets. I use it in my cooking. And, if there's a finer cooking tool that costs practically nothing, I can't imagine what it is.
All this from Sherry Castle. We're talking about a lot of things, but mostly about her new book, the New Southern Garden Cookbook. She and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Sherry Castle. She's is Southern Village, is that where you
live? I live in Southern Village.
What we like to say now is Chapel Hill, Carrboro, a neighbor of ours. And we're excited because a new book, the New Southern Garden Cookbook, that's published by our own UNC Press. The subtitle is Enjoying the Best from Homegrown Gardens, Farmers Markets, Roadside Stands, and CSA Farm Boxes. All the kinds of ways that you and I can get fresh foods, either from our own garden or from somebody else's garden, during the seasons. Sherry, one of the things that intrigued me about your book and about you is that you not only had experience as a food writer, but you've had experience in the kitchen working with other food writers, testing their recipes. I love your book. I mean, man, it's great, but I'm real interested. I mean, you can't tell us everything. I mean, but you can tell us what you will about the different ways in which our different favorite teachers of cooking and cookbook writers test their recipes.
Okay. For me, I can tell you very briefly how I test mine, then I'll tell you how I test for other people, my clients. For me, these had to work in the real world. It was vitally important to me that the recipes in this book, and it's narrowed down, if you can believe it, it's narrowed down to 350. I made somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 different things as contenders for the book, and, had various reasons for choosing.
I wish I'd been around.
Yes, I wish you had been too. I fed my whole neighborhood for a full year, all sorts of folks. It had to be practical. It had to be family friendly. It had to suit my family. It had to be a great representation of this product.
The methodology and what the tricky parts of it are, where the possibilities of messing up are, how you control for that, what happens.
I think that for every writing project, whether it's my own or for someone else, you have to decide where is your starting point. And that seems elemental, but it's actually a critical spot. We can no longer presume that people have basic cooking skills. If you looked at a cookbook even from just a couple of decades ago, it didn't tell you a lot. It's sort of like the way our GPS is in our car. It tells you where to turn, but it doesn't tell you how to drive the car. That's where our recipes were. They just gave you the basics. Well, I decided that I wanted mine to be accessible to cooks of all ranges. So I put lots of tips and hints in there. Lots of little things. This is what you look for. This is what it's going to look like. This is how you'll know when it's ready or where it should be. I write in a very conversational style, just as though I were going to tell you or my teenage daughter or a neighbor or something. If you were to just bump into me at the farmer's market and say, how do I make this? I write in that
same
style.
Let me ask you this. Focusing back on the actual testing, is it, can you do your own testing? Because, I mean, you've written it. You know what you meant. You follow your own directions, but how do you build into the testing process just what you're talking about, which is the fact that I don't know what you're talking about?
Well, I turn my cap around and I become a different kind of cook. I'm an intuitive cook. Many of us are. I'm a pinch of this or that, you know, home cook. But when I'm writing to put it on paper to give people what I believe are reliable guidelines to make the food for themselves, I take temperatures and I set timers and I have two laptops, a legal pad, colored pencils. I have measurements, you know, dry, metric, scales, different kinds of temperature probes. I am a very, very, very careful data collector when I'm writing a recipe for paper as opposed to when I'm just writing it for us to eat. It's a completely different mindset. And there aren't a lot of cooks who can do that.
Well, do you start with a recipe and test that recipe to see how it works, or do you start some other place in order to get to the recipe?
I start somewhere else. I start more often with an idea. Even if it's something I've made for years, when it comes to writing it, I make it as though it were new to me. You know, how thick is this? What temperature is that? How long did that take? When do you flip
it? So you start, if you say, I don't always cook from recipe because I kind of cook, I'm intuitive.
Right.
But what you do then is to take your intuitive way of cooking and then measure it along the way? Is that sort of the idea?
I do. And, you know, there are certain things. When you're a cook, just as if you're a musician, once you know what key you're in, you know where to start the song. There are things about cooking that are repeatable, whether you're cooking apples or zucchini. If you're doing a sauté, there's a certain way you sauté things or roast things. You know, there are principles that are going to apply. You're not reinventing the wheel necessarily every time. Where the more creative part comes in is, what's going to be my twist or what new flavor combinations am I going to bring here? What's my interpretation of this classic that probably everybody has had? And I think about food all the time. It's my profession. It's also, I'm wildly curious about it. I love it. I think I kind of hum a tune in my head of food like people do that are songwriters or whatever. I carry around a notebook where if I'm walking my dog and I get an idea, I can either call my cell phone and leave myself a message or jot it down or something like that. And sometimes those ideas are fully rendered the first time. It's like, man, I hit that. That's great. Sometimes it takes a try or two. And sometimes it's like, well, that just wasn't very good after all, was it?
It was a good idea that didn't work.
Right.
All right. Now, let me, I hate to push you along because you're talking about real interesting stuff, but I want to now get inside the kitchen or the project in which you are helping somebody else who's writing a cookbook or writing an article or testing a recipe. Now, that you have to handle that differently because they hand you a recipe, I guess, and they test it for
you. No, that's the part that is actually the most surprising to folks that don't know there are professional recipe testers. Very rarely do I actually begin with a recipe. That, in all the work I do, the least common approach is for someone to say, here is a finished stack of recipes. Double check them for me. It more often is here's my idea. Can you write a recipe about this?
Oh, wow.
Or I would like to have 24 recipes about peaches or something like that, where I actually write the recipe from the ground up.
This is not fair, but in a sense,
I'm a ghostwriter.
You're a ghostwriter for a wonderful person who's got great ideas about cooking and that you work in partnership with, but that you have a more important, it's not really food testing. You are cooperating in recipe building.
It's development. It's what we would call development. And, I have had partnership where it's open, where I've done recipe testing with wonderful cooks who really did know what they wanted and what their vision was, but perhaps it's a restaurant person who isn't accustomed to making small amounts that are appropriate for home kitchens. Sometimes I'm hired to do recipes for high-profile people that really don't have recipe skills. They have a different personality or something like that.
You're like, here's what you are. Now, you just arguing with me about this. You're like the backup singer for one of the great country music acts, and that person is relying on you to sustain the act, and you do that, and you're that person's partner, and then all of a sudden you say, I want to do my own show.
Exactly.
And this is new book that you've written or put together for us, the new Southern Garden Cookbook. Am I close? Is that right?
Yeah, that's hitting on some of it. It really is. But, you know, I had always wanted to do my own book. Clearly, you know, I have.
All right. Now, who is your partner? Have you got anybody that helps you?
No, this is your solo act. Yes. For better or for worse, it all rests
now,
on
do
my
you miss,
shoulders.
I mean, now you've been out there mm-hmm. selling. Part of your mm-hmm. role is selling mm-hmm. your usefulness as somebody who works as a partner for
right.
somebody. And then after doing all of that, you're like the lawyer who represents himself or herself. Mm-hmm. You go out and do it on your own. Now, don't you miss the companionship and miss somebody
Not
checking?
Not in the slightest. it is such a privilege and was such a joy to get to express my point of view rather than sounding either neutral or sounding exactly like someone else because I was writing a book that had to sound exactly like mm-hmm. so-and-so and so-and-so. This one sounds like me, you know, and I'm not, you know, this is the way I cook and this is the way I look at this. This is my point of view and it's nice to get to, you know.
All right, now if you're like me, I'm talking mm-hmm. If you're listening to mm-hmm. Sherry and me talk about it, and Sherry's not going to disclose on the air her prior partnerships, but go to her website. And you can find out some of the, if you want to.
You can find out a few, but I will also tell you there are some that are so secret that I basically said they could have my child in my kidney if I ever revealed who it was.
All right. Well, if you want to find out more, and not just for that, not just for answering that question, but also for some really good cooking help and for more about Sherry Castle, go to her website. You can, of course, go to our website on chapelburr.com, and we'll have a link to her website there. She and I are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk more about the new Southern Garden Cookbook, and we'll do that with the author of that book, Sherry Castle. We'll be right back.
Chapelburr.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelburr.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Sherry Castle, our neighbor here in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, and or as we say around here now, Chapelburr, has written her first cookbook, the new Southern Garden Cookbook. It's not the first thing you've written, is it, Sherry?
No, I've been writing for a long time. Actually, even before I included professional cooking in my repertoire, I was trained as a writer, been a lifelong writer, but I was always the person that cooked. I wrote my first recipe to mail into a TV show when I was 4 years old.
I see you talk about that in your book.
I do. But, you know, growing up, I was the person that cooked. I was the girlfriend that cooked. In college, I was the person, let's go to Sherry's. She's going to make real food
Where
on
did
Sunday.
We talked earlier about your mountain growing up. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Watauga County. Near Boone, and my family moved to town, left the farm, came to town for factory jobs so that I could go to school.
There were factory jobs in Boone.
There were two factories, there was one that made electronics that is still there, and there was one that made undergarments.
But Watauga County is really interesting county in North Carolina in the sense that mountain people, really mm-hmm. real mountain people, mm-hmm. live there, and then working class people. But it's all surrounded by this great. You know, it was the Appalachian State Teachers College and this great university that's developed mm-hmm. that had a big influence mm-hmm. on people in the schools in Watauga County that you wouldn't have expected.
Exactly.
So a lot of people break out of the mm-hmm. mountain mountain experience and just really make good. They bring that mountain culture and ethic into the workplace. So you're one of them.
I'm one of those. I'm wildly, wildly proud of my mountain heritage. I mean, I'm from way back up in a holler. I mean,
what's the name of the nearest community?
Zionville.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay,
the people next to Zionville don't know it's there. That's how small it is. But it's right on the North Carolina-Tennessee state line. And, you know, I came from very humble but wonderful family. But I went to elementary school at Appalachian State Teachers College.
Right.
What they did back then is to put student teachers in the school. They put a school on campus. And so that's where I grew up and had amazing exposure to the symphony and to moon rocks and to literature and so forth. So I really think I had the best of both things. I had a very traditional, humble family.
And did
family
you stay
life.
There to go to college too?
No. By the time I got there, man, I wanted down off the mountain. I really did. So I was the first person in my family to go away to college, to go away at all. I came to Carolina. I like to say I've been gone for 33 years and my dad thinks it's a phase.
You're still coming
back.
Coming back sometime soon. Well, there are lots of other questions I wanted to ask you, but you've just finished finished writing a book always turns out to be an even harder assignment than you thought it would be. Mm-hmm. Then you have this moment of real excitement when you get to hold it in your hands. Mm-hmm. Did you swear off writing another book along the way, or do you see another possibility of a book?
I think that it's almost inevitable I'll write something else, but I don't know what it is yet. You know, until I can say it as articulately as I could tell you what this book was about. When I got it down to I could tell you in a sentence what my book was going to be, I was ready to write it. I'm not there yet. I have some things mulling about. It might be another cookbook. It might not. I like to write fiction. I like to write all sorts of things. And so I think that given my predilections, it would be stunning if I didn't write something else. I just don't know what exactly yet.
All right. Well, before we close, we're just about out of time, but now you've tempted me because you said you reduced to one sentence what this mm-hmm. New Southern Garden cookbook is all about. What was that one sentence?
It was practical, easy, enjoyable ways to have good food and a mighty good read.
Wow. Well, that's what you've done. It's that kind of book, and I thank you very much for sharing your experience writing it and some of the great, wonderful recipes that many of which are simple enough even for me to aspire to cook. So thanks, Sherry Castle. Thanks, all y'all, for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be right back here before you know it.